From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Arlington, Virginia.
And I'm Celeste Headley down the road in up the road in Bethesda, Maryland. It's Here and Now. Russian forces have intensified their attacks in the eastern Ukrainian region known as the Donbas, where Ukrainians have already been fighting pro-Moscow separatist forces for 8 years. And there are renewed talks of a humanitarian corridor for civilians escaping the besieged city of Mariupol. Ukrainians hold up in a steel plant there, refused to give in as a Russian deadline for surrender passed today. David Stern is a foreign contributor for our editorial partners with The Washington Post, and he joins us now for more from Ukraine. Hi there, David.
Hi there.
So you have been speaking with people who are trapped in Mariupol. You actually spoke with a commander of the troops who are stuck inside that steel plant. Here's a little bit of that.
Це наше звернення до світу. Це може бути нашим останнім зверненням. В нас, можливо, залишилися.
What did he tell you?
Well, yes, that was Sergei Volina. He's the commander of the Marine troops there. There are different groups of fighters, Ukrainians, that are in the steel plant. He told me about the situation there. Obviously, they're surrounded. They're being bombed constantly. They're suffering heavy losses. There are civilians, women and children who are among them. This is a large, it's a sprawling industrial location, the Azovstal steel plant. I think it covers around 4 square miles. So they're holed up in there, and they've been there for quite some time now. They're holding off the Russian forces. But he described quite a dire situation. He said it was critical.
You asked if he'd be willing to negotiate with Russian forces to guarantee safe passage. What did he say?
He said that they would be willing to leave if they got the command from their commanders, but they didn't trust the Russians. They said in the past there have been incidents where Russians have promised safe passage and then they've opened fire. So they said whatever the situation, they weren't laying down their arms. And he made a plea to world leaders, but in particular to President Biden. He's hoping for some sort of what he described as extraction procedure, where possibly they would go to a third country, and a third country would guarantee their safety. But he was adamant that, of course, they don't trust the Russians at all.
Russian forces failed to take the capital, Kyiv. How significant would a victory of any kind in Mariupol be for Russian forces?
We'll see how significant, because there are a lot of factors. Obviously, this would be a setback for the Ukrainians. Potentially, it could help create, or if not create, a land bridge connecting the southern part of Ukraine to the Donbass region. The last fighters are in the steel plant, the last Ukrainian fighters, that is. Once they are gone, then obviously the Russians have Mariupol. But we'll see exactly how the Russians can translate this, and what perhaps the Ukrainians' response or counterattack could be.
So Russia has said this is the next phase of its war in Ukraine. As we mentioned, Donbas is home to pro-Moscow separatists. They have been fighting to become part of Russia for 8 years. How does the presence of those separatist forces change the balance in that region?
Well, it should be said that the pro-Moscow separatists are also Moscow-backed and Moscow-directed. They're not an independent group.
Meaning they're not that separate.
Yeah, they're not exactly. They're not that separate. But they've always been a factor in the mm-hmm. war. There has been fighting in the east of the country since 2014. I would say that it doesn't necessarily tip the balance. In fact, the Ukrainians, as we found out, are very experienced, very battle-hardened. These last 8 years of war have given them a great deal of preparation, which obviously the Russians are only now finding out about, that, you know, that it's been extensive and very effective.
In earlier weeks of the Russian invasion, soldiers were often fighting in suburban areas. The Donbas region is more rural than that, and some experts predict this will become a war of attrition, that soldiers will dig into trenches, that they'll make use of bunkers that exist there. What is your sense for how Ukrainian soldiers are preparing for what could be a very long, drawn-out conflict?
Well, exactly what you're saying. They're preparing for what could be a drawn-out conflict, what could be a war of attrition. I guess what you could say is the Ukrainians are ready for whatever. They're not giving up. Many Ukrainians are confident not only that they can win, but that they can force the Russians to realize that they're not going to win this war and inflict enough losses on them that they that brings them to the table to negotiate. But the Ukrainians, both the Ukrainian army and the Ukrainian people, have really come together. This is a war on their country. They're not. This is not something, even if they wanted to turn their back on it, they can't. So whatever the Russians throw at them, they're going to deal with it. We'll see how much they're going to inflict. But I would imagine that they're going to try to counter anything that the Russians do.
David Stern is a foreign contributor with The Washington Post. David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Help is coming for millions of low-income student loan borrowers. These borrowers were hurt by a government program known as Income-Driven Repayment Plans, IDR plans, were supposed to bring affordable payments and eventual loan forgiveness. But an NPR investigation found the Department of Education badly mismanaged these plans. And after the report came out, lawmakers demanded an investigation, and now the government is working to change the program. NPR correspondent and senior editor Corey Turner is here to talk about it. Hey, Corey.
Hey, Scott.
So these income-driven repayment plans, first of all, for low-income borrowers, how are they supposed to work?
Yeah, so IDR was supposed to make sure borrowers can afford their monthly payments, and it did that by tying those payments to income, also folks' family size. And for people who don't earn a lot, they can actually have a $0 monthly payment, which in turn earns them credit towards what has always been the big promise of these IDR plans, which is that after 20 to 25 years, the federal government promises to erase whatever debts are left. And research shows that nearly half of borrowers in IDR are low income enough that they are making $0 payments, which is why this promise of forgiveness isn't just nice. It's really vital for many borrowers. It's the whole point of enrolling in IDR. And over the years, though, it's become clear that these plans just weren't keeping that promise.
And so tell us about that and the results of your team's investigation earlier this month.
Yeah, so borrowers and their advocates have complained for years, really, about IDR being hard to enroll in and to stay in because of really rigid paperwork requirements. So borrowers often ended up in these costly long-term forbearances instead of IDR, which is the fault of both loan servicers as well as the result of really bad oversight by the Ed Department. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and a bunch of state attorneys general actually sued a loan servicer a few years ago for this. Earlier this month, then, NPR revealed a whole host of other serious problems. We found that some servicers weren't actually tracking borrowers' progress toward loan forgiveness. We found that people making those $0 payments might not actually be getting credit toward loan forgiveness after all. And we found that early record keeping for IDR was pretty awful.
Wow. And so now the Department of Education has outlined some reforms. What can you tell us about them?
Yeah, so first of all, for the folks I mentioned who spent more than 12 months straight or 36 months total in one of these long-term forbearances, that time is now going to count toward loan forgiveness. The department estimates that at least 3.5 million borrowers are going to get at least 3 years of new credit now through this fix-a-loan. It's also saying that any months in which borrowers made payments are going to count toward IDR and eventual loan forgiveness, regardless of the repayment plan they're in. Department even says it's also going to start tracking borrowers' progress toward forgiveness itself instead of just leaving it to the servicers. In all, the department says these changes should help more than 40,000 borrowers become immediately eligible for debt cancellation, and it's going to bring millions more borrowers a lot closer to that eventual debt cancellation. I spoke late yesterday with Persis Yu, who is one of the people I've spoken to several times before. She's done a lot to call attention to IDR's failures, and she's now at the Student Borrower Protection Center.
I am concerned that this fix actually reaches all of the borrowers, but certainly it has the potential to really be huge for remedying many of the problems that has plagued IDR over the last several decades.
Okay, Corey. So for borrowers who are hearing this news, perhaps for the first time now, what do they need to do?
Yeah. So for most borrowers, they need to do nothing for now. The department says it is going to review and update borrower records automatically. This will take several months. This is also important, though. It won't be able to make these changes until the fall. Also, do not call your loan servicer. I got a joint statement from several groups that represent loan servicers, and they were frustrated, saying the department hadn't shared any of these changes with servicers ahead of yesterday's announcement. And they complained that as a result, servicers aren't going to be able to provide clear and concise information to borrowers who call with questions. So really, my best advice right now is be patient.
NPR's Corey Turner. Corey, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
In the war in Ukraine, a new round of military aid is expected from the United States. It would be the second in 2 weeks. This as Russian forces step up preparations in the east and Ukrainian troops mount a potential last stand in Mariupol. Now, individual Americans have gone over to fight on their own, and that includes Malcolm Nance, a former Navy cryptologist. He's a terrorism analyst and former contributor to MSNBC. And this week, Nance said he had joined a group of foreign fighters in Ukraine. From Ukraine, Malcolm Nance, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's glad to be here under certain circumstances.
Well, let me ask you about the circumstances. You went over, you said about a month ago. What was it that made you decide, you know what, I want to go over and fight?
Well, if any of your listeners know me from MSNBC, I was the terrorism, intelligence, and national security analyst, and I spent most of January in right up to the day of the invasion in February, analyzing the Russian order of battle, which roads, we actually drove every road that the Russians would have to invade on to get a feel for the type of activities, you know, how long it would take them to move, how many gas stations, things like that. You know, there's nothing that can be substituted from being on the ground and when you're talking about an invasion by a large force. And while I was there, I became friends with people that it turns out that I had known in some instances who were in the Ukrainian army, other graduates of Defense Language Institute, where I went to school, you know, when I was a baby cryptologist, and, you know, interpreters who were assigned at the battlefront and down in Advitsa, which is where Ukraine has been facing off against the Russians and their occupation forces since 2014. And we were briefed by the battle commander there. And at the end of our briefing, you know, when most journalists were asking him ludicrous questions like, what are you going to do when the Russians come? And he goes, I've got the Russians 210 feet to our east. You know, he jokingly said while we were taking a selfie, he goes, you clearly have been in the military. Why don't you join our army? And I said, well, you know, I said, we'll see about that. You want a four-year contract. And within days, you know, 10 days later, my friends who were there, who were actually the interpreters for that press junket, were calling us and saying, we're going to die tonight. You know, we're being hit with we've been hit with 500 rounds of artillery and mortar. And in the past year, they had like 12. So the Russians were full on invading and they were going to kill everyone there. And you know, it just it woke something in me, and that feeling of what are you doing? You know, you're going on air, you're giving color commentary, you're pointing to maps, and you're saying this is what's happening with Russia. You were just on the ground there, and these are your friends, and you know people are going to die. All the nice people that you met are going to be at risk of dying, including I was in a hotel in Kyiv, and my neighbors were Afghan refugees. You know, including this cute little boy, Muhammad, who would come over and open our room door because he, you know, 2 years old, knows how to open your doors. And they had left Afghanistan and were now in the middle of an amazing invasion. And, you know, the first reports of people, you know, that, you know, dying and some of the horrific scenes, I said, that's it. I'm done. I didn't renew my contract, which was coming up. And I went over. I took my military.
Your cable TV contract, you mean?
Right.
So because you'd been in touch with these people on the ground in Ukraine, you get yourself there. You have been on TV in the States with a rifle and combat gear. Are you in a combat unit now? What can you tell us?
Yeah, you might have heard that on 27 February, President Zelensky announced that they were forming a unit of foreign fighters, asking for foreign volunteers to come and to join a Ukrainian army unit called the International Legion for Ukrainian Defense. And mm-hmm. that is an official Ukrainian army foreign legion. It is a legion made up of people from many nationalities. I mean, just on the one bus that I took to go to training, and the people arrayed behind me was an American woman who was a combat veteran medic with the Marines, an Australian, a New Zealander, a German next to me, a Pole, and a Colombian. That's just the rows
wow.
of two seats yeah, that yeah. I was sitting in. And most of the bus was Americans. And that was one bus four and a half, almost 5 weeks ago. So, yeah. The organization is very large. These are not freelancers, people who just went there, wanted to get a rifle and go out there. They've been trained, they've been vetted, they have equipment, and they are sistered up, they're married up on the battlefield with an mm-hmm. equal Ukrainian army battalion.
And on the battlefield, you on the battlefield are doing what? What can you tell us about what you're doing?
Well, for the most part, right now, every legionnaire is a combat veteran, and every legionnaire is expected to do combat, is expected mm-hmm. to be on the line in some way, shape, or form. There's no rear area jobs. There are no logistics or training jobs, things like that. Each individual organization that gets assembled has its officers that are Ukrainian, and the soldiers themselves, based on their experience, pick the non-commissioned officers to lead them, and then they go and they patrol and carry out combat operations as designated by the Ukrainian army, just like every yeah. other mm-hmm. Ukrainian army unit that's out there. And if the okay. Russians attack, you defend. If you're on the attack, you attack.
Hmm. And combat operations where? It had been reported that you are or were in Lviv.
Well, I'm not on the line right now. As a matter of fact, I'm a special mm-hmm. little snowflake. Principally because there was a concern that I was just so high profile. I had 1 million followers on Twitter. I had thousands of, 50,000 on Facebook or some crazy number. And, of course, I was the face. I was the only African-American in national security in the entirety of US
media. Oh, so they
media.
Decided we can't afford to put you on the combat front?
No, that's not it. They decided that to roll out the Legion, they would bring its most high-profile person. And I feel that I'm a good spokesman for the Legion right now. They have a press secretary, they have a PR person, but they wanted to show that there's been a lot of press that the Legion, in some instances, said didn't even exist. It was never formed or it collapsed. And
okay.
With my profile, I could reveal the Legion as a major force in
okay.
this country and answer questions properly.
And so just to understand, so you're speaking for this foreign legion, are you also on the combat front?
Well, I'm not right now, but I will be. And every person in the legion is expected to be. So
okay.
The combat front in Ukraine is Ukraine. Where I'm at at this undisclosed location in Western Ukraine is uh-huh. where our logistics and training hubs are and where the press is, to be quite honest. You have to drive 7-10 hours to get to Kyiv. The siege of Kyiv, the fighting there has been lifted. Now the real war mm-hmm. is occurring near Kharkiv on the Russian border with the attacks mm-hmm. in the Azovian mm-hmm. salient and down into the south. And those operations are ongoing and they won't end in the next week, that's for sure.
Okay. Well, Malcolm, on social media, some are calling you a hero. Others question what you're doing. And my question for you is, what if you or another American, say from that bus, get captured and suddenly the U.S. Yeah. gets drawn into this war much more directly than it is now?
Well, the United States can't get drawn much more into this war than it is right now. The presence of American citizens is not necessarily a factor that I would expect the White House to have to work with. So, you know, I was chief of survival, you know, evasion, resistance, and escape. So I'm well aware of what happens when you have a hostile force that does not respect the Geneva Convention, that engages in brutality. But let me tell you something very specific. The Russians don't care who they're killing. They don't care if it's a Black American Legionnaire or if it's a, you know, a Colombian or if it's a Ukrainian child. These people are a horde. They are not a military force. So the risk to me, as opposed to the average citizen near the battlefront, is much, much less severe than it is to, you know, the average person who happens to be in the path of this horde.
Are you worried about being captured, about being wounded, killed?
No, not at all. I mean, I spent 20 years in the U.S. Armed Forces. I spent 15 more years working for directly in the U.S. intelligence community. And I have my brothers and sisters in the Legion to my left and my right. You know, we all have a purpose here. We are here to defend the people of Ukraine. If I'm killed, well, then I've given my life for a cause that I came here to believe with. And perhaps, you know, that loss, that sacrifice will mean that maybe 10 or 15 kids won't get killed. And whatever I can do to help the war effort, I'm going to do it.
Malcolm Nance, terrorism expert and former Navy cryptologist, has joined the Legion of Foreign Fighters in Ukraine, and he speaks to us from Western Ukraine. Malcolm, thank you for the time, and stay safe.
My pleasure.
The Russian attack on Ukraine has prompted Americans to send support overseas. Many are also thinking about the ties that connect the U.S. to Ukraine. That's particularly the case in Arlington County, Virginia, which has been a sister city to Ivano-Frankivsk in western Ukraine for more than a decade. Over the years, people from both places have visited each other and participated in student and professional exchanges. Now the war in Ukraine makes those ties between Arlington and Ivano-Frankivsk all the more significant. Margaret Barthel of member station WAMU has more.
These days, 81-year-old Kristia Sonevetsky stays in her home in Arlington, Virginia, and watches the news.
I sit by the television all the time, and I watch it, and I cry, and I get angry, and everything happens.
The sights and sounds of destruction and pain on screen take her back to a different time, when she was growing up during the Second World War. She remembers going to bed in her clothes and having to run to shelter underground when air raid sirens went off.
It brings me back to my childhood because I remember bombs falling and I remember those sirens. And that is one memory that has stuck with me through all these years, probably from the time I was 4 years old.
That was in Poland, where her parents fled from their native Ukraine as Russian troops advanced. Her family stayed in a displaced persons camp there, and then they immigrated to Canada and then the United States. She's called Arlington home for more than 30 years, but wanted to keep her family's roots close.
I became interested in sister cities probably in the early 90s. And right from the very beginning, I wanted to see if maybe we could forge a relationship with Ukraine.
Almost two decades later, Sonevetsky got her wish. In 2011, Arlington signed a sister city agreement with Ivano-Frankivsk, a city of 240,000 people in the foothills of the Carpathian Mountains in Ukraine, and the place Sonevetsky's mother spent her teenage years.
It's a cultural hub and hotspot. There's a lot of art and music there.
That's Sophia Taylor, a Ukrainian-American who is now the co-president of the group that oversees the partnership between the two cities under the Arlington Sister City Association. A few years ago, firefighters from Ivano-Frankivsk came to Arlington to swap knowledge. A group of Arlington middle schoolers also visited Ukraine. Members of the Arlington County Board and the mayor of Ivano-Frankivsk have also traded visits. But now, in the face of the latest Russian invasion of Ukraine, the Arlington group is focused on sending humanitarian aid to their counterparts in Ivano-Frankivsk, The city is far enough west to have been spared the worst so far, though Russian forces bombed its airport, according to Taylor.
The people who are on the ground there and who live there are working really, really tirelessly right now for the war effort.
Meanwhile, the Arlington County Board passed a resolution standing in solidarity with Ivano-Frankivsk and connected its mayor to the State Department for help sourcing weapons and supplies. Taylor and other volunteers are raising money and helping educate their fellow Arlingtonians about the relationship to Ivano-Frankivsk. Krystia Sonovetsky has high hopes for that work.
I think it would be wonderful if Arlingtonians, not only of Ukrainian descent, but Arlingtonians, would become aware of the fact, because most people would not even know that there is a sister city, you know?
A sister city that brings a conflict happening half a world away, a little closer to home. For Here and Now, I'm Margaret Barthel.
If you're a mom or know a mom, you probably know the job often comes with a lot of self-doubt. Everybody has an opinion about how you could be doing better. Products are marketed to you by raising fears that you're harming your children. And questions about how to be a good mom are all over the media and the blogs and social media. So maybe the success of a new book by comedy writer Glenn Buzan shouldn't come as a surprise. It's called There Are Moms Way Worse Than You. It came out at the end of March and just debuted as one of Amazon's top 10 bestsellers. Glenn Buzan joins me to talk about the book. Welcome.
Hi, Celeste. Thank you for having me.
So there has to be a story about how you got the idea for this book, right?
There is. Also, first of all, great intro. Can I steal that for when I describe my book? That
was fantastic. Away. It's not even theft if you have permission.
About a year or so ago, I was hanging out with my sister and my niece, who was around 2 at the time, and my sister was pregnant with her second. And my sister is the perfect mother. She was born to be a mother, and yet she was expressing to me these fears about being a bad mom. She kept saying, oh, I wonder if I'm socializing Maddie enough. I wonder if I'm feeding her the right foods. And when I tell you my sister is a good mom, my niece's favorite activity is reading. And her favorite food is radishes. So she is a great mother. I'm not a parent myself, so I didn't really know how to comfort her as, you know, a fellow mom would. What I wish I had said was some beautiful quote about motherhood or, you know, a generational love and blah, blah, blah. But I'm a comedian and sort of a dummy. And so I just said, well, hamster moms eat their babies, so, well, I don't know. At least you're not doing that.
Did this comfort her?
It did a little bit, and she laughed. And in that moment, I thought, oh, this is what I can do to sort of make her feel better.
So you began to collect stories of animal mothers who did horrifying things to their children. And at what at what point did it become a book?
Yes, so it started off as a Mother's Day poem for my sister. I was just going to give it to her, and she was the only person who was going to see it. And then I was asking around for illustrators, and my manager and his wife read it, and they went, wait a minute, this resonates with us as parents. We should make this into a book. And I thought, oh, okay. So what originally started as just a card for my sister turned into this book that I wanted to still keep it a surprise for her, so she ended up not seeing it until a year and a half later. Because I wanted to surprise her.
Wow, it's a pretty good secret keeper you are.
I know. I was dying. Whenever we hung out, I was like, don't say anything. So, yeah, I kept a secret for about a year and a half because, you know, books take a while to become books.
Okay, so on the cover, it's just an iconic cover. It has
thank you.
A giraffe mom kicking her baby.
Correct.
I thought, well, that's ridiculous. Giraffes obviously don't kick their babies, but then
oh,
of
Celeste.
Course, I know I read many tales. One from Wild Trails was so poetic in saying she lifts her long legs and kicks the baby giraffe, sending it flying up in the air and tumbling on the ground. And as the baby lies curled up, the mother kicks the baby again. Like, you're not kidding.
I'm really not. I was stunned when I did the research for a lot of these animal mothers. They're horrible.
Yeah, just awful. Yes. And you keep reminding us of those kind of things. There's another one where you say an eagle mom believes in survival for the strong. She'll let her eaglets fight to the death. How wrong.
Yes.
What were some of your favorite tidbits that you found?
I really like the cuckoo bird mom. She's what's called a parasite brooder, I think is the name for it, which means she will lay an egg in another bird's nest and just leave it for that other bird to raise it.
Right. It's the equivalent of walking your kid next door and hoping they don't realize they're raising another child.
Exactly. And I just thought that was such a power move, and I really respect it.
So writing books is not something that you do. You are
not
a comedy
usually.
Writer.
Yes,
you've
not
worked
usually.
With Conan O'Brien and with Sarah Silverman. They, in fact, were both quoted in the Amazon reviews. Mm-hmm. Were you a little nervous about taking on a book project?
A little bit, because when you say you're an author, people assume you wrote a big, wonderful novel. And so I have to go, oh, no, I'm not a real author. I wrote a tiny joke book. I'm not a James Joyce. I'm not a Mary Shelley. So I did feel a little nervous having to say I'm an author.
But what was it like to work with an illustrator? Because that's a partnership that you have to curate. You have to, you know, nurture it.
I got so lucky in the illustrator department. Priscilla is the illustrator, Priscilla Whitty, and she is also super funny herself, which was, I got so lucky. She thought of a lot of the visuals for the book as well.
So the title obviously refers to moms, but you also write, and I'm going to quote you here, it's not just moms. Some dads suck too. They're not all warm and snuggly. A pipefish dad will eat his kids if he thinks they're ugly. So I assume that any parent of any gender, stripe, style can read this and just insert their own identifier in here.
Absolutely. Being a bad parent is devoid of class or race or gender. Anyone can be a bad parent, which is the beautiful thing about parenthood.
And the beauty of this concept is that you can now start on aunts and uncles.
Yes.
Grandparents, you can just move your way through the entire family tree.
The concept of animals having grandparents actually makes me laugh on its own. That's very funny.
Oh, well, you're going to enjoy that research. No spoilers. Yes. There. But I have to ask you, when your sister finally read the book, mm-hmm. what did she think?
I'm happy to report she laughed and teared up a little bit. She was very, and also she was like, how did you keep this from me for so long? And I said,
I'm impressed
it was
that
hard. Yeah, it was very hard for me. It's interesting because this book, I will say, There Are Moms Way Worse Than You, by the title, is a book for moms who have a sense of humor. And my sister has the best sense of humor. So she appreciated it, and she read it, and she laughed, and she saw her name in the dedication, and she went, oh my gosh, that's me. So
did your niece also read it?
So the book looks like a children's book, sort of, but it's not for kids.
Yeah,
the kids
for
just
sure.
end up reading it. Yeah. Yeah. So my sister did read it to my niece, Maddie, and she read her the part about, there's an animal in here, the koala mom, who famously, the first solid meal that she feeds her koala babies is her own poop. Can I say
yeah,
that?
Yeah, let me read the line from the book. For dinner, a koala mom will feed her kids her poop. Remember that when you give yours fast food. Okay, continue.
Yes. She read my niece, my three-year-old niece, the part about a koala mom feeding her kids her poop. And my niece was like, Mom, you don't do that to me. And my sister was like, yeah, correct. And she goes, you're a good mommy.
And also poop cute? Is an objectively funny word.
I know. And also she just then, my niece is 3 years old, so she then just took the opportunity and ran with it and just kept saying poop over and over again for like 30 minutes. So it was very funny for all.
Yeah, I support that. Any ideas why your book has hit such a nerve?
I think it's because, and I don't like that this is the fact, but I think it's because there's so much pressure in the world today, sort of like you were saying in the beginning, how everyone's trying to sell you something to make you a better mom, or everyone is judging other moms and dads to make themselves feel better. And because it's maybe one of the most important things you can do as a human, you know, raising another human, it's so important to get it right. And that's, I think, why people take it so seriously and they take it to heart. And so with that comes a lot of self-judgment and a lot of shame. So unfortunately, because there's a lot of shame surrounding parenthood, I think that's why the book resonates, which was my, if one mom feels better about herself after reading a silly little joke book that I wrote, I am thrilled. So.
Well, my son's 23 and the book still brought me some comfort. So thank you.
Celeste, that honestly, I love when moms who have grown kids read it and they go, ah, yeah.
Yep.
Because that's my favorite.
It's all a compromise. Yeah. Glenn Pouzin's book is called There Are Moms Way Worse Than You, Irrefutable Proof That You Are Indeed a Fantastic Parent. Glenn, thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste. This was so fun.
And now, to space. Where scientists have found connections between ice in Greenland and similar formations on Jupiter's moon Europa, some 390 million miles away. And these connections mean that, yes, Europa could have the ingredients to sustain life. And one of those scientists joins us now. Dustin Schroeder is Associate Professor of Geophysics at Stanford University. He's also a science team member for the Europa Clipper, which NASA plans to launch in 2024. Dustin, welcome.
Thank you.
Dustin, your team has been looking at ice structures on Greenland, and you realize, your team realized, oh, wait a second, this looks really similar to the formations on Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter. What's the connection here, and why does that matter?
Across the surface are these striking double ridge features, which are long features with symmetric ridges on either side of a trough in the middle. And people have studied these and tried to explain how they formed for some time. Our group, which studies both Europa and Earth's ice sheets using radar, discovered some double ridge features in the surface of Greenland that are much smaller, only a couple meters high, but had radar data that allowed us to see beneath those double ridges in Greenland and see how they were formed. And in Greenland, we see they're formed by pockets of water that are refreezing. And by understanding those features in Greenland, they suggest that if the same process covers the formation of the double ridges on Europa, that there would be pockets of water underneath these ridges all over Europa, suggesting that water may be much more abundant in the middle of the ice shelf than we would have thought.
And what does this mean for the possibility of life there?
So the motivating factor behind the Europa Clipper mission is to try and understand the habitability of Europa. One of the things that makes Europa super exciting is it's got a global ocean underneath its ice shell, and evidence suggests that ocean has more liquid water than we have on Earth. So that by itself is a very exciting prospect for habitability. However, that ocean is separated from the surface, from space, by a thick ice shell. On the surface of the ice shell, you get chemicals from space and from nearby moons like Io. And to have a good shot for habitability, or the optimal case we would like, would be for those chemicals to have a way to get down into the water. So one option for that may be the case, is to get them all the way into the ocean. Mm. But these pockets of water being in the ice shell, forming these ridges, brings water closer to the surface. And that increases the chance that you'll have an opportunity for exchange to get those chemicals into the water. Mm. And that is hopeful news for that to be a potentially habitable piece of water.
So I'm curious how you as a scientist reacted when you first started hearing this could be a possibility. This could look like Greenland with all of the possibilities of potential life there. Is that one of those things where you jump out of your chair?
So I think this was a real joy of advising a research group. So my group does ice penetrating radar both on Earth and other planets. I have a postdoc who's one of the authors of the paper, who's now at the Jet Propulsion Lab, who was studying Europa in general and was giving a talk in my group where he showed several things we couldn't explain, including these double ridges. Another one of my students, Riley, who's a PhD student, who's the lead author on the group, was studying the near surface of Greenland to understand the effects of extreme warming events on the ice sheet and to understand the impact of climate change on ice flow. And it just happened to be the case that my student Riley that day had been looking at radar data and saw these small 2-meter-high double ridges in Greenland.
Oh my goodness. It's good you had these students together in the room.
It is. It is. It's a real, it's a joy of being an educator to have that happen together, to have that discovery happen. And then, yes, once that commonality was seen, we spent months just diving in, trying to understand how things formed in Greenland and starting to see that picture come together and see it explain what we saw at Europa as well. So, yes, it was definitely, you know, one of these exciting discovery moments.
Okay, and briefly, as far as what's next, you are involved with the Europa Clipper mission, an orbiting probe planned for launch in 2024. Just briefly, help us understand what's the next step as far as that mission and what it may tell us.
What I'm excited about is that mission also includes an ice-penetrating radar, which is the same type of instrument we used to study these features in Greenland. And so if similar water bodies do exist in the ice shell at Europa, we're bringing along the sort of instrument we want in order to see them in the same way we saw them here on Earth. And that's, for me, the most exciting thing is to have an insight like this from Earth and then be well positioned to test that hypothesis when the spacecraft gets there.
To Europa and beyond, as they say. Dustin Schroeder, Associate Professor of Geophysics at Stanford University. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Arlington, Virginia, USA, on planet Earth.
And I'm Celeste Headley in Bethesda, Maryland. Same Earth. It's Here and Now.